In these weeks that are leading up to the Feast of Trumpets, we've been taking on a series of messages to review some of the events that will take place before Jesus Christ returns. The Bible describes that period of time as one that will be challenging for the world in general and certainly for God's people in particular. But those scriptures are given to us so that we can be prepared, so that Christians living in that time frame will recognize what is happening. Last week, we talked about what will happen within the church toward the end of the age. And I emphasized that there would be tribulation and persecution that would occur during that period of time. Today, I want to back up just a little bit from that and review the underlying cause of that persecution, that difficulty that will challenge the church at the end of the age. So the title of the sermon today is The False Church at the End of the Age. The first thing for us to consider as we look at this topic is that the false church began almost immediately after the true church was established. The seeds of the false church were planted, so to speak, and they began to bear fruit almost immediately after Jesus Christ died. We know that the church was established in the year 31 AD on the Pentecost that followed his crucifixion. But almost again, immediately at that same point in time, there began to be some misrepresentation and false teaching about Jesus Christ, which ultimately led to an organized false church. Turn with me to begin to Matthew chapter 24. Matthew, the 24th chapter. We're very familiar with the words of Jesus Christ after he had been asked by his disciples to explain to them what would be the sign of his return and of the end of this age. And the first thing that Jesus said about that period of time is in verse 4. Jesus answered and he said to them, "Take heed that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I'm the Christ,' and will deceive many." Many have come over the centuries claiming to represent Jesus Christ, claiming to be teaching of him and his way, but in fact, they have a message that is deceitful and leads people in the wrong direction. Satan began to work right away to pervert the teachings of Jesus, which again led eventually to this organized false church. After the first century, after we get to the end of the New Testament, which was completed in about the year 95, as John received the vision that's in the book of Revelation, the church began to fade from view, and it quickly became obscured by a different set of beliefs and teachings. In fact, literally a different gospel. Paul warned about that in Galatians chapter 1, verse 6. Galatians chapter 1, verse 6. And we should note that Galatians was one of the earlier epistles that Paul wrote, probably around the year 49, between, say, 49 and 52 AD, about the same time that they had the conference in Jerusalem, at which they decided about the Gentiles and that they need not be circumcised. So this was very early in the history of the New Testament church. And Paul mentions in verse 6 of Galatians chapter 1, he said, "I marvel that you are turning away so soon from him who called you in the grace of Christ to a different gospel," a different message that changed, perverted, and obscured the truth that Jesus Christ came. Paul also mentions this. I'll just refer to 2 Corinthians 11, verses 3 and 4, where this was written maybe 10 years later, in the early 50s. I'm sorry, in the late 50s, about 57 or so A.D., maybe 6 or 8 years after Galatians. Paul writes that he fears that this false message would deceive the church just as Adam and Eve had been, or as Eve had been deceived. So this deception began almost immediately after Christ died and after he established his church, and it has continued through time. We know that there's a pattern here, a correlation between Revelation 6 and Matthew 24. In Revelation chapter 6, verse 2, we find the first of the seals that is opened. The very first of the events that are described that will be prevalent at the end of the age. Revelation chapter 6, verse 2, I looked, and behold, a white horse. He who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him. And he went out conquering and to conquer. At first glance, this might seem to be a reference to Jesus Christ. This horseman is in white, he has a crown, and at first glance, maybe that's a reference to Jesus Christ. But as you read the rest of the context here, the rest of the seals as they're opened, it certainly would not fit the context to assume that this is referring to Jesus Christ. It is, in fact, referring to someone who is deceitful, someone who is not what he appears to be, just as Jesus had warned in Matthew 24, that there would be a deceit that would follow immediately after his death, after his departure. This horseman is aggressive. He goes to conquer, and he represents a deceitful and false Christianity, which, again, was the very first of the signs that Jesus gave relating to the end of the age. Back to Matthew 24. Because there's more to what Jesus said about the things that would happen to bring deception at the end of the age. Matthew 24, verse 22, is the summary about the Great Tribulation, that unless those days were shortened, then no flesh would be saved alive. All of mankind is in danger by the events that would take place during that time. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. It will stop short of the annihilation of all mankind. But notice verse 23. And this is in the context of the end of the age. Verse 23, if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the very elect. Great signs and wonders that will be very strongly deceptive. The word great means in the upper range of an extent. It means something that is far and above what would be expected. And there's an implication that these are important things that are taking place. So there are things that are being done at the end of the age that are deceitful, that are even miraculous, and that will confuse the entire world and even be a threat, to the elect, except that they can be protected from it. And we'll see that as we go. The false teachings that began when Christ first warned of them immediately after his death intensify and become more confusing as the last days approach. If we fast forward to what Jesus described as this time of great tribulation, this time that is more difficult, more painful than has ever occurred in the history of mankind, Consider the suffering that people will endure, the confusion that people will experience. They'll be looking for answers. It'll be a prime time for Satan to begin to interject his deception and to bring about further confusion. False teachers will deceive many at the end of the age, not only by what they teach, but by the supernatural miracles that they will be able to perform. Not just something that's deceptive in itself or a trick or magic, but actual miracles that they will be able to perform, signs and wonders, which will give some credibility to who they are. After all, if they can perform a miracle, then God must be with them. And this kind of situation or circumstance will certainly cause a great deal of confusion and deception. Now, we can only begin to try to imagine how what that scenario will be. When we try to think about how it might develop, it might seem really bizarre and out of anything, beyond anything we've ever experienced. Try to imagine the conditions that would allow those kinds of, or that level of deception to begin. But again, the tribulation itself will be a time of that is unique and different. And the situations, however it comes about, will lend themselves to those who will be used to deceive mankind. As we observe the Feast of Trumpets in a few weeks, we are confident in our belief, in our understanding of what that day represents. That will be the time when Jesus will begin to intervene. Ultimately, Jesus will return to the earth, and the first resurrection will take place. We anticipate that time that is to come. But at the end of the age, if we look at this verse and consider it on a personal level, at the end of this age, the faith of those Christians who hold that belief will be challenged. There will be so much happening around, so much developing, so much that is confusing in the way that circumstances are, that this false teaching will be strong enough to lead everyone astray, except for those who are the elect, those who are the chosen of God. But we have a responsibility if we're going to be among those who maintain that faith. It's not as simple as just being in church each Sabbath and knowing the meaning of the holy days. There's much more to it. Ultimately, this false Christianity that is described in general terms will be unified under one powerful leader. There will be one individual who will lead the teaching of this false Christianity at the end of the age. Right now, it's very fragmented, but it will come together under one very powerful man. He's described in the epistle that Paul wrote to the church at Thessalonica. 1 and 2 Thessalonians were probably Paul's earliest epistles, written likely in about the year 50 to 51 AD. Remember that in 1 Thessalonians, Paul reminded the church that death doesn't mean that hope is lost. The members in this early church, I call it a young church because it had just begun. It doesn't mean the people were all young, but it was a young church in the sense of its organization and coming together. And they weren't strongly and firmly established yet in their understanding and in their faith. Paul had taught them, we'll see, about the resurrections. He had taught them about the return of Jesus Christ, but they had become discouraged and confused. There were members of their congregation who had died, and that was completely unexpected. Everyone was going to live to the time and see the return of Jesus Christ. So when they lost some of their members to death, it was very perplexing to them and even discouraging. So Paul wrote in 1 Thessalonians about the return of Jesus Christ and the hope of those who had died and of the resurrection that will happen at his return. But let's page ahead to 2 Thessalonians. This was written about a year after the first epistle. And there still is some confusion among the members in this congregation. Chapter 2, verse 1. Now, brethren, concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our gathering together to him, we ask you not to be soon shaken in mind or troubled either by spirit or by word or by letter, as if from us, as though the day of Christ had come. At least some in this congregation, in this church, were confused and troubled by reports that they had heard that Jesus Christ had already returned. Now, wouldn't that be something that would shake you up? If you heard that Jesus Christ had already returned, and here you are, still in West Virginia, East Ohio, just kind of, nothing happened, nothing changed. There was no resurrection, there was no kingdom. That would really be confusing if you were troubled by that kind of a rumor. Verse 3, let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition. Don't be deceived by any means. The means by which they were deceived were apparently letters from those who claimed to be apostles, maybe even some who claimed to be writing as Paul himself. In our setting, obviously, if you find it on the internet, then it's true. And so people can be confused by rumors that they hear. People can be confused and perplexed by things that others say is happening. And people sometimes panic and get all rattled when they hear something that is troubling to them. Paul says, calm down. Don't be deceived by something that seems like it's supposed to have come from me or from the church. And he assures them that there are some things that will happen first before the time Jesus will return. Two things in particular. First of all, a falling away. And secondly, the revealing of the man of sin. Those must occur before Jesus will return. The falling away is a term that's translated from Greek that means apostasy or rebellion. Apostasy, rebellion, or abandonment. This implies that there will be a deliberate change of belief. The falling away involves a choice to stop believing, an intentional abandonment of something that was previously believed. The falling away is a turning away from what they had put their faith in. These are people who had believed the truth, but had changed their position and deliberately turned away from their understanding. Now, since Paul is writing here, and we'll see it as we continue, describing this falling away as a sign of the return of Jesus Christ, it is something that is yet to take place. There have been some events in the past that have been perhaps parallel. The establishing of the false church in the 4th century is not what this falling away was about. That was a drift, that was an evolution, that was a change that took place, but it is not the change or the falling away that Paul is referring to. Back in the mid-1990s, when the worldwide Church of God broke up and was scattered, many believed that that was a fulfillment of this prophecy. But we see as we continue that it is not, it cannot be, because those involved in it are pictured, that things are done that happen at the end, at the time of the return of Jesus Christ. So there could have been some similarities. There certainly were, as far as the change, the split, the massive departure from God's way of life, but it's not the falling away that Paul is referring to here. We can see this as a warning that we need to be careful. That deception we've talked about is going to be powerful and strong. There is a time coming when those who seem today to believe will deliberately turn from what they believe. So the falling away will come before Christ returns. And secondly, the man of sin will be revealed. The man of sin means that sin is his defining characteristic. It is what he is about. And in terms of his rejection of God's law, he's not trying to hide anything. It is something that just defines who he is. He leads people to perdition or ruin or destruction. That's the result that comes from what this man of sin will introduce. Verse 4, the man of sin, son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. This verse describes the arrogance of this man of sin, that he proclaims his authority over everything, and that it is he who can declare what people should worship and what they should believe. He claims the authority of God and acts as if he is God. And it says that he sits in the temple of God. What exactly the temple of God is, as Paul refers to it, is not really clear. It may refer to a literal temple, or at least some place of worship in Jerusalem at the time when this individual asserts his authority. But remember that Jesus Christ is the head of his church. He is not going to relinquish his position to anyone. He will never leave or forsake his people. Any claim that any human being might make, or even Satan himself might make, means nothing in terms of who is really God and who is really at the head of his church. But this verse illustrates the character, the arrogance of this man of sin who places himself in that position. Verse 5, Paul chides the church just a little bit. He says, look, don't you remember that when I was with you, I told you all these things? He's already taught them or revealed to them these events, but now he's reviewing it with them because they allowed themselves to get confused, to get rattled by rumors that they were hearing that somehow undermined what they had been told, what they had learned previously. Verse 6, and now you know what is restraining, that he may be revealed in his own time. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. In other words, again, God is in control. Jesus Christ is the head of his church. He will not allow things to happen until it is time for them to occur. He is restraining what Satan wants to do, and frankly, what he has the power to do, except that God holds him back until it is the time that he declares. Remember in Acts chapter 1, verse 7, the disciples had asked Jesus if he at that point was going to set up the kingdom. And his response to them was that only God has the authority over the times and seasons. The schedule is on God's calendar. He is the one who will decide when events will unfold. He is controlling the timing. And these these things that Satan would wish to do, he is not allowed to do until God withholds or holds back the restraints and lets Satan go about his business. The mystery of lawlessness is already at work. There's a hidden agenda, so to speak, that Satan is working outside of God's law, the lawlessness, that Satan is already laying the groundwork for. False teachings about Jesus Christ have always been out there, but the full force of Satan's deception, again, is being held back, even though it's at work in the background, on the level that God still allows it at this time. When the time is right, God will remove those restraints, and Satan will proceed with his plan. Verse 8, after these restraints are taken away, then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. This verse establishes that this man of sin emerges, and these events that Paul is describing here take place just before Jesus Christ returns. This man will perform miracles. Verse 9, the coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan with all power, signs, and lying wonders, and with all deception. So the power of the deceptive, Satan's deception will be unleashed. This man will perform miracles. This false religious leader will perform actual, genuine miracles, just as we saw is mentioned in Matthew 24. Not magic, not counterfeit, but supernatural, because Satan has that power. He can do things that are beyond what is natural or to us and to humans. Satan is able to perform those miracles, and he will do so in order to support this false religious leader. Comment from the expositor's commentary says in this verse, a superhuman person will utilize the supernatural means of miracles, signs, and wonders. They will not be counterfeit, but genuine supernatural feats to produce false impressions, deluding people to the point of accepting the lie as truth. When someone says something and then backs it up with an incredible miracle, that lends credibility to what they've said, to what they've taught. And this will be enough to deceive mankind at that point. Verse 10, with all unrighteous deception among those who perish. Let me read it together with verse 9. It's a part of the same sentence. The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan with all power, signs, and lying wonders, and with all unrighteous deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. This man's motive, as he is driven by Satan, is simply to deceive. And this would imply that he is doing so intentionally. He's intentionally teaching what is false. Satan certainly knows better. Satan knows who God is and what God's plan is. But he, in defiance of that, wants people to be led in a different direction. And it seems that this individual himself is purposely, again, being led by Satan, setting out to deceive. He is empowered by Satan. He has the same motive as Satan. And his intent is to confuse and to deceive and to lie to those who are perishing. Those who are perishing means those who do not understand the truth, those who are not on the path to life. Paul uses this same phrase earlier, and well, actually, it was somewhat later chronologically, in 1 Corinthians 1, verse 18. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 18. He says this: "The message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God." So this reference in 2 Thessalonians 2, that those to those who perish, is a reference to those who do not understand, are not aware of the truth of God. Again, a note from expositors. Those who are perishing will be particularly vulnerable to trickery. Not only will they confuse unrighteousness with righteousness, but they'll attribute deity to the lawless one. They'll look at this lawless man of sin as God. Now, in the world at that time, most will be ignorant of the truth. Most will be among those who are perishing because they never were aware of God or God's plan or God's law. But remember that this is a message of warning to the church. This epistle is not written to the world in general. It is written to the church. And it refers here to those who did not receive the love of the truth. They will be among those who are deceived. What does it mean to receive the love of the truth? The word receive can be translated to accept or believe. Those who did not accept or believe the word, the love of the truth. In other words, those who love the truth are those who receive it, who believe it, and who build their lives on that truth. Those who abandon or turn away from the truth will be deceived. How can the elect not be deceived? Why will the elect not be deceived? Because they did receive, believe, and love the truth. They live by the truth. That truth then is embedded in their character and in their thoughts. They will not be shaken or troubled by false teachings because they are firmly established. So the question we ask ourselves, am I aware of the truth? Or do I accept, believe, and love the truth? The answer to that question is in how we live. If we build our lives on that truth, then we will be on a solid foundation and we will not be troubled, shaken, or confused. But those who do not receive the love of the truth will be among those, along with the rest of the world, that will be deceived. Verse 11, "And for this reason God will send them a strong delusion that they should believe the lie, that they all may be condemned who did not believe the truth but had pleasure in unrighteousness." This strong delusion comes from God in the sense that he removes the restraint and allows Satan to proceed with what he wants to do. Satan can only act on what God allows him to do. And when God, again, withdraws that restraint, then in a sense, he is sending or allowing that delusion to come upon them, that they should believe the lie. Those who are vulnerable, those who don't love the truth, those who are perishing, will be among those who will accept the lie. What is the lie? The lie is the doctrine, the set of teachings of Satan and his way. The lie that's spoken of here is not a specific false statement, but it is the collective message of Satan and of this person who is representing him. Notice it stands in contrast, verse 12, those who did not believe the truth. Again, the truth is not just one specific statement. The truth is the teaching of God. The lie is the teaching of Satan and all the different variations and in ways that he teaches his false message. So this delusion will come upon those who do not love the truth, and they are in a position, they're set up so that they would then be vulnerable to and be drawn into the false teaching of Satan as opposed to the truthful teaching that God provides for us in his word and by his calling. So this is a summary that Paul gives here in this chapter of some major events that will take place, and it has to do with the establishing of this system of a false religion at the end of the age, headed by a man of sin who will, using the power of Satan, be able to very convincingly lie to mankind and to deceive and mislead. This same individual is also referred to in Revelation 13. Let's go back to Revelation chapter 13. This is a little more complicated prophecy, and given as much as put into this chapter, we're going to pass over part of it for now and come back to it later. There are two beasts that are described in this chapter. The first is described in verses 1 through 10. He's a great, powerful military dictator who takes control over the nations of the world. And again, we'll discuss that in more detail, because we see beginning in verse 11, he works in conjunction with a second person, also called a beast. There's a military dictator who's called a beast, described in the first 10 verses, and then there's another beast that's described beginning in verse 11. This second beast is the powerful religious leader that Paul was describing in 2 Thessalonians 2. We'll see the similarities as we review these verses that refer to him. And again, we'll come back to the other beast in another time when we talk about the military national side of this beast power at the end of the age. For now, we're focusing on the false church. Revelation 13, verse 11 says, "Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon." So here we find the same description of a person who is deceitful, who is not what he appears or wants to appear to be. He looks like an innocent lamb, but in reality is a fierce and destructive dragon, similar to what we saw in Revelation 6, the man who comes on a horse, and it would bear some resemblance to Christ, but actually is deceitful in how he presents himself. Verse 12, "And he exercises this beast all the authority of the first beast in his presence, and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed." Again, that's something we'll get into next time. But this, the second beast, the one we're talking about, this religious leader, works in conjunction with the first beast, and he actually causes people to worship. So there's some form of there's a religious aspect to this, where the religious leader is causing people or leading people to the worship of this first beast, this military dictator beast. Verse 13, he, this is the second beast, performs great signs, so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast. So part of his deception is to lead people to worship the first beast. But here we see that he causes people then, by these miracles that he performs, to worship what is called here the image of the beast. He deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived, and he was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast. Now again, this is very symbolic language, and it is a little bit difficult to try to understand in a literal sense. This worship the image of the beast means that the religious leader gives credibility to and makes authentic the first beast. The first beast is worshipped because the second beast, the religious leader, gives that credibility. He performs these miracles that are so impressive and that mean so much to those who observe them. And based on that credibility he has, he lends his credibility to the first beast and directs, leads, causes people to worship him. And people will be forced under the threat of death to respect and to submit and to worship this beast that has control over them. It's presented as if it'll be a form of an actual religion, literally bowing down to and worshiping this first beast. In the past, you may recall that Roman emperors considered themselves to be gods, and they demanded to be worshiped by those that they ruled over. Remember the example of Nebuchadnezzar. He built an image of himself, and then he commanded his subjects to bow down and to worship that image. So the two beasts that are described here work very closely, hand in hand, so to speak, and they support each other. The religious beast lends his credibility to the military dictator beast and causes people to worship that first beast. So back up to verse 14 and kind of work our way through again. He deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded. Verse 15, he was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast. In other words, he gave authority or credibility to the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. They form this system of worship based on the support of the religious leader. And as many as would not worship the image of the beast would be killed. Verse 16, he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads. So first of all, again, notice that they are caused or forced to worship the image of the beast or die. What do you suppose is going to be the response to those who love the truth, those who have not abandoned the truth, This will be a time when they, of course, will have to stand their ground and not be willing to worship this false system which comes about at the end of the age. This beast, this religious beast, controls the earth in the sense of its economy, because he has the authority to cause all, everyone, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, all receive a mark on their right hand and foreheads that no one can buy or sell unless they have that mark. So this religious beast, working in conjunction with the first one, first beast, will have the authority to enforce a system in which those who are not marked on their right hand or forehead really have no means of any kind of financial transaction. They can't buy, they can't sell. You can't get food, you can't work, because you don't have that mark on your hand or on your forehead. So what is that? Is that a microchip? Is that a tattoo that you're somehow stamped with that identifies you as being one of those who is part of that system? Is it your social security number? Over the years, there's been a lot of concern about anything that identifies every individual, that's going to be the mark of the beast. And that's how they're going to know who you are, and that's how they're going to control you. Well, I don't know if there's going to be a literal mark on your hand or on your forehead. Technology exists to make that possible. There are ways to identify and track everyone if that's what this is about. And they could identify by some technological means those who submit to the beast and those who don't, to prevent, if you don't have that microchip or that stamp on your forehead, you can't go into Giant Eagle and buy any groceries. No one will hire you. That'll be that much of a control. But what is the mark itself? Like I said, it could be something literal and physical, but this much we can know for sure. Obedience to God is a mark or sign of those who are His. Obedience to God identifies us as His people. Observing the Sabbath, it says in Exodus 31, is a sign between God and His people. God's people observe His Sabbath. If there is some kind of a forced control that requires a person to work on Saturday because Sunday is now the day of rest, and you don't cooperate, you're marked. You're identified. It's easy to distinguish that you are not in support of the beast or the false prophet. So the Sabbath could very well be a significant sign that will be evident during these troubling times. God told Israel, let's turn to Exodus chapter 13. I think it's an interesting statement. It's right after the Passover is established and just at the time of the first keeping of the days of unleavened bread. Exodus chapter 13. Verse 8 says that you teach your son why you do these things, because of what the Lord did for me, verse 8, when I came up from Egypt. Verse 9, it shall be a sign on your hand and a memorial between your eyes, that the Lord's law may be in your mouth. Your right hand in your forehead. Satan's mark is, in effect, a counterfeit of God's way of identifying who are His people. You're identified by what you do and by what you think, how you behave, how you live your life. Your right hand or your hand represents your actions, your labor, what you do. And the forehead symbolizes thoughts and intellect and belief. So the mark of the beast identifies those who, by the way they live, obey the beast, live according to what he demands of them. It is evidence. It is evident by what they do, what they think, and how they live. Those who love the truth and are faithful to God will do and think differently and will be easily identified and separated from those who accept the mark of the beast. Those who will not submit to his authority, to the beast's authority, will be punished, will be persecuted. They will not be allowed to be part of the system. Back in Revelation 13, verse 17, that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. His number is 666. Isn't it amazing how many different interpretations there are of what this number means? It is the, you know, the identify, it, and all these books about spiritual Satanism and evil at the end of the age, it's, you know, some poor child is born with the number 666 on his forehead, and all these incredible fictions about what the meaning of that is. It's really not nearly, I guess, in terms of reality, as exciting as some of the books and some of the ways it's been portrayed in various fiction. There's a number, 666, which identifies the beast. Some years ago, there was a lady in the church who was received Social Security for her income. And she got a pay increase, as they get from each year, a certain percentage increase usually. And her new monthly check was going to be $666. She said, you know, I'm going to call the Social Security Administration and ask them to keep a dollar a month so that I'm not getting $666 from the government every month. I tried to explain to her that really wasn't a concern. But she was convinced. I don't know what she actually was able to do. Maybe she just took a dollar and threw it away every month. I don't know. But there's all kinds of superstition about this number and fear about this number. The number 666 does identify the beast. Now, you're probably already familiar that in the Greek language, letters were assigned numerical values. And so a name spelled out in the Greek language would have, if you convert that letter in the alphabet to its numerical value, there have been many historical figures over the years, including some Roman emperors and religious leaders, whose names totaled out, when you translate it from the Greek and then add them all up, to 666. But that apparently they were not the beast. Who will this man be? Well, we don't know. There's no way for us to know. But when the man of sin is revealed, we're told here that those with godly wisdom will recognize who he is. There have been some thought or concern about some political leaders in Europe over the years, and maybe that person was going to be the beast, and there'd be some effort to try to figure out how to associate the number with his name. This is one of those things that we simply have to see when it happens. And again, those with wisdom. You know, Daniel says that those at the end of the age with wisdom will understand, will have understanding. And there's much that we will need to be able to perceive and understand as they develop in the future. Let's conclude today by going back to 2 Peter chapter 3. We've talked a bit about a great religious, I say great meaning powerful, religious leader, a false leader who will deceive mankind and who will cause a great deal of harm to the church because he will have authority to execute those who will not comply, those who will not worship and be part of that system that the beast represents. We stand today, I believe rightfully, secure in our understanding of these events as much as we can understand. We recognize that there are many things that will take place over the coming years, and the events that we're seeing here today that describe this end-time religious, end-time church, could very well take place in our lives. We need to be aware of that. And we perhaps wonder, well, how could I possibly ever be deceived? How could I ever be drawn into? How could I lose the confidence that I have? Well, hopefully that is as impossible as it might seem to you. But it's not something to take for granted. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 17. As we consider the understanding we have through our observance of the Feast of Trumpets, through our understanding of various prophecies that are given about the end of the age, remember this. You, therefore, beloved, since you know this beforehand, and remember we read the words of Jesus Christ after he described these events that would take place, he said, "See, I have told you beforehand. I've warned you of the things that are going to come." And Peter rehearses that same thought. Since you know this beforehand, beware. Beware lest you fall from your own steadfastness, being led away with the error of the wicked. But grow in the grace and knowledge of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. To him be the glory both now and forever. Amen. It is a profound understatement to say that there will be challenging times at the end of the age. It's going to be a time of tribulation and difficulty, the likes of which mankind has never experienced, and certainly the likes of which the church has never experienced. The transition from this age to the rule of Jesus Christ will not be easy. It will not be simple. The world is going to fight to its dying breath against the one who is coming to save them. The world will be deceived. But those who love the truth will stand strong and be faithful, looking forward to that return, and able to withstand the deception, the powerful deception of the church, the false church, at the end of this age.